So it is
Okay.
the top of the hour, and I've gone ahead and turned on the broadcast and record button. In true cyber faculty fashion, we've been talking about summer treats and food and soju. This is ELT Live being streamed on August 26th, 2015, on most of the planet. Semesters are beginning or have already begun in certain parts, and I'm aiming to get ELT Live going again this semester as just a place to bounce ideas off each other and see what's going on in our classrooms. So with that said, I'm Jeff. I'm in Busan, Korea.
I'm Vance. I'm in Al Ain, United Arab Emirates, and I like learning together with other people and hanging out with Jeff.
Hi, I'm Maria. Greetings from Argentina. Always glad to hang out with you.
Ben Stewart here from beautiful Aguascalientes, Mexico.
And I'm Dan. I'm here in Korea, actually, technically, Paju, trying to get to a good place in my basement for a signal.
I liked the walk-in you did there with Daniels when you went far from the camera. It was sort of like a very nice entrance. And Maria, I just wanted to mention your audio was very low. I don't know which mic we're getting you from, but you were kind of low.
My mic is?
No, Maria.
Oh, sorry.
I noticed it got stronger toward the end. Maybe you could do another check. Ah, there you go.
Maybe it was this one.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's fine now.
So, who wants to start? What are they working on? What have they got planned? Benjamin, you've already got 2 weeks behind you. Any wisdom to share? Any momentum you'd like to carry over?
Yeah, I guess the biggest change for me this semester, I think, is just we're looking at Office 365 here at the university where I teach. They have subscribed to Office 365 for business account, which is essentially one intranet that incorporates all of the tools for Office. And so I kind of dived in and brought my students with me into this new for us platform where we're basically using OneNote. So all of my planning I'm sharing with my students with OneNote, and they have access to basically everything that we do there. And we're using groups, obviously the email function, but groups, I don't know if you're familiar with groups with Office 365, but it's kind of part of the email service. So we're using groups, we're using Word Online to edit documents, since most of my groups, in fact, all three of my groups that I'm teaching this semester are writing classes. So we're sharing documents, making them public, and commenting on each other's work. And so we're doing it primarily all within Office 365, and trying to make everything as public as possible. That's been the biggest challenge. So far, only OneNote and the Word documents have been able to be made public. The group feature is not public unless you're within, again, the intranet, have an account here at the university, and are able to access Office 365. So for us, we're basically, that's kind of something new that we're doing this semester, and we'll see how it goes, but so far so good.
I think this has come up before. How does it compare with Google Docs? What are the advantages? It must be for if you pay money for something that, Google provides something similar for free.
That's a good question, and you know, for our purposes, since the university is offering accounts for both the teachers and the students. Now, when I say they offer accounts, basically what that means is that teachers and students have access not only to the platform online, but they can also install Office under the computers. Teachers are allowed to install onto five machines, Word, Excel, PowerPoint. And so that was one thing. The second for me was trying to find a way. I like the idea of having, you know, most of what we do in one space from the perspective of our students, so I don't ask my students to sign into too many accounts because that can become cumbersome. It can become kind of an issue if the students feel that they're not going to use those accounts afterwards. But as far as comparing it with Google Docs, it's primarily the same. I say primarily because Office is undergoing some changes, and they have just started implementing this real-time edit feature that Google Docs has had for years, whereas you know people can access at the same time. You can see who's accessing what part of the document, where the cursor is, and Word Online is just now coming to that feature. They're just now implementing that feature. Even without that feature, as far as my within my context, that's not a big issue because typically what happens is students and I interact asynchronously typically on the document. So it'll be nice to have that feature where simultaneously we can access the same document, but it's not really it wasn't really a deal breaker at the beginning. But I think, you know, the Word is behind, but I think that basically they're going to be having the same features at the end of the day as Google Docs. And, you know, the issue here that I see, obviously, is just the licensing difference, right? So Google Docs is free. Word Online, at some point, someone has to pay for it. If it's not the institution, obviously the individual. Again, within our context, students already have these licenses, so I'm just trying to take advantage of that.
So is all of the writing happening on these docs, which you said is not publicly viewable, do you have any public space for them to publish and reach an audience?
Yeah, so, and that's a big issue here. You know, if you're familiar with Office Online, you know, they have sites, you know, for business. Now, I'm primarily talking about Office 365 for business, which is slightly different as far as the way I understand it than a personal account. But there is a sites feature, so you can have your own website within Office 365. You can have groups, as I mentioned. We have OneNote. We have Word Online. So of all those different tools that are available through Office 365, there's only two tools that are made available to the public, and that is OneNote. So all of my planning, I've created OneNote. I don't know if you're familiar with OneNote, but you can set up pages and sections, and you can really organize your ideas quite well. I particularly like OneNote. But you can make that document public, even though it's within Office 365. And also the Word document that the students are working on throughout the semester is also made public. So OneNote is made public, and the Word document is made public. And so what I do is I create a list with the students' names with the respective links in OneNote so that technically, you know, anyone could, one, access OneNote, and two, access the individual documents that where the students are working.
I'm anyone. Do you have a link that we can check out?
Yep. Let me...
And Vance also mentioned in the chat room that he's there in the chat room. Do others know where it is? And always a good idea to mention that there is a text chat room at eltlive.com/live. And to our one viewer, we'd love to see you there.
Yeah. Go there. Maybe that viewer is there. Oh, no, it could be me, actually. I've got that open on another computer. So I'm just a chatter.
While Benjamin is finding that link, I'm also teaching a composition course this semester, and I'm sticking with Google Docs, but doing something a little bit different than I've done in the past and setting up a folder for each section, and within that folder, a subfolder for each student. And so that's, and it's shared with just me and that student. And if I wanted, I could share with the whole class. And that way, all their writing is just going to live in there. And it will automatically be editable by me, which is a little bit tidier than I've done before. But I think that's going to work out okay. And here is the link to...
What are some of the files or information that you include in the folder that's one level up in the document where the student document is. I mean, is there anything else beyond the actual document?
No.
Working that you plan to keep in those students?
No, all of that would be on a course website, on a Blogger. And I'm thinking for now just sharing it with me and the student and giving them it, the choice. If they want to share it with classmates, okay. If not, okay. But also they're going to have their own blog and need to post some stuff there occasionally or frequently.
Jeff, do you use Doctopus?
I did when you mentioned it last time, and it was impressive, but confusing a little bit to me. But I have it installed. Can you convince me to fall in love with it?
How many students do you have in your classes?
15.
Yeah, so it's still small enough that you could probably manage those. Last semester I had 80.
And what are the virtues of Doctopus?
It automates all the, it makes all the folders for you and sets permissions and sends out all the files and organizes it for you. So instead of making 80 files, I just go through one setup and it sends all the files out to the students, and then I'm able to, it's kind of the same setup in that there's one folder that has all the assignments, and I can just go through all the assignments in that folder.
So you are pumping out files or documents.
Oh, yeah, you know, Doctopus is essentially a document management system.
Because I actually docs for output. I use it more for input. Like, it's usually the students who are posting their assignments. I don't usually, because all the assignments are on the course website.
With Doctopus, you'd make an assignment, and you have a template, and now you can choose to send it out to groups or all students or whatever. But so in essence, I'll make one assignment and I'll send it out to the group, and then the students will write their paper on that document.
When you say group, and, are you talking like a Google group or is there something, a Doctopus group? Or?
I put in my class roster, and that's what I'm considering the group.
Okay.
And sends it out to every student in the class.
I just Googled it, and it's associated with Goobrick. Can you tell us anything about that?
I can tell you I never use it. I probably should. Okay. But you can use it with Goobrick, which is maybe a nicer way to provide feedback for the students, and so you can attach a rubric to each of those assignments as well, and it's just kind of an easy form to fill out for each student.
Okay. That's nice.
Interesting. With regard to rubrics, I'm curious, Danielle or anyone, if you're using rubrics, how are you using them, and if you're using like holistic type rubrics or more analytical type rubrics?
I'm teaching writing, and when I make an assignment, I have to give my students very specific instructions about what to do, and so I always kind of turn the instructions inside out and make a rubric from it. So then I make a checklist, assign point values to the things I ask them to do. But I guess that's because my guys are, they're pilot cadets, and they're not that oriented in the classroom, and they just need to, they don't read instructions very well. It does, my courses work on rubrics like that. I mean, as far as getting the students to do what I ask them to do, and then I use Google Docs to work with them to negotiate the kinds of critical thinking that I want them to have in their writing. So that Google Docs is really good for that. And on Jeff's organization by student, I organize by assignment, because usually I put all the students' files on one assignment in a particular folder. And then when I open that folder, what I'm looking at, what I need is right there. Whereas if it's on each student, then I'd have to go and I guess, dig up the... Well, actually, I use the search in Google Docs to find the students' writings, and, of course, the share with me. And other stuff I could talk about later if you want, like the voice tools. I'm quite into that stuff now.
No time like now, but I did want to say hello to David if he's joined us again. D, you are David, right?
I'm not sure if you can hear me.
Yes, we did.
Okay, I'm gonna put myself on mute simply because I've got a lot of little things to do and I don't want the racket in the background disturbing the conversation.
All right, well, feel free to chime in.
I was on the bus earlier. All right. So, thank you for the invite, by the way.
Thanks for joining, and chime in anytime.
Okay.
So, Vance, I wanted to hear about what you're doing with voice. Benjamin, is there anything you wanted to say about use of Word and OneNote and stuff before moving on?
No, not particularly, unless if you want to talk about something else, go right ahead. That's fine.
Okay. I did check out your OneNote online space, and I can see it's very well organized. Got the student documents, and you're a very prepared professor.
Well, it's still a work in progress, but yeah, any suggestions later on, if you're, feel free to leave those with me. I appreciate those. But it's just still kind of...
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Okay, go ahead.
Using Word online, does it have the same tracking features that the software?
Tracking as far as prior revisions and being able to track further prior revisions? Yes, it does. It's a little quirky, a little weird to get to. It's not as nice and easy as Google Docs. But yes, you can go back and view, or if need be, revert back to prior versions of the document. And as you know, I think there's some value in that anytime students or teachers can view that progress, see how many edits have been made. Just like Word or Google Docs, if a student is editing in Word online, it saves automatically. In fact, there's not even a save feature because it saves... if you're connected, obviously, to the internet. So
does it show the edits like Google Docs? That's one of my favorite features, where you can do the view file revisions and you can see all the words that I deleted or changed. Or
that's a good question. I think it does. I'd have to check again. I seldom, so far this semester, have used that, and I can't recall exactly how it appears when you click back the prior version, if there's some sort of indication of the changes. But to my knowledge, I can't think of anything that stands out. I can't really answer that. Sure.
Thanks.
Vance,
sounds like a good topic. Yeah. Go ahead with your. I was just saying to Benjamin that it sounds like a good topic for a future Learning Together discussion. But anyway, we can put that off to later. So, Jeff, go on with your question.
You had mentioned doing stuff with voice. What are you doing with the voice?
Okay. I've got a link I can stick in the... I stuck it in Chatwing, and if you want to copy it... Oh, cool. Okay, that was an acceptance from Benjamin. Okay, so if... I've made a blog post. I've been doing kind of... experiments with voice, the voice tool is native to the iPad, your Android devices. There's a little record button, but some of the things that you can do with that, when I'm doing it in my office, people sometimes will come over my shoulder and say, "Well, I didn't know you could do that," or my students will, "Oh, wow, that's cool," you know. So it's still got a little wow factor to it, but then that article that I just pasted, yes, thank you for putting it over here. Since it's on a different computer, it's kind of hard to get it back onto this Hangout computer. So that article sort of takes what I've been doing with voice and writing up through several presentations I've done over the past couple of years with a group of colleagues. We've been our last one was in ISTE at Philadelphia. That's actually, I guess, what that comes from. But basically, I wrote it up in that blog post. But it's, well, okay, so suppose you're in Google Docs and your class is working, you know, on their iPads. My class has iPads. You could actually, they could be on laptops as well. There's a lot of differences between iPads and working in Google Docs is a little difficult. One of the difficult things about using iPads for writing is, of course, the data entry. The students are getting kind of good with their thumbs, but the better way to do it, if you can, is to just read or say what you want into the iPad. Now, it's kind of interesting to be walking around the class, or the students will come up, or whatever. Anyway, you can have the. I've got a PC in my class, and I can project on the screen from the PC or from the iPad, for that matter. But I don't like to be tethered on the iPad. I like to have it in my hand and be walking around, and so I can bring up the students' documents. And if they ask me, or I can go around. They're always asking me to read what they've written, and I can, if I want to make a comment, I can just read it right there into the document while I'm in the middle of the class. So that's kind of neat. Also, I have the students write on paper. The tests they take on paper. Some teachers are on paper. That is, they have to write in pencil on a test. And some of the teachers I work with think that they should actually practice that in class. It's kind of like people used to feel about handwriting, you know, that they used to think that they'd lose the skill if they didn't just sit down and write things out and blot up the paper and throw it away, you know, that sort of kind of thing. But I used to tell teachers I worked with that if they're using word processors, that's what they should get the students to use. But anyway, that was some time ago. But one thing that I find myself doing a lot is reading into the device instead of writing into it. And for example, if you're working with students on a certain conversation style or genre that you want them to perform on or to do, or you want to see how can you start this essay, you can get the students, you can elicit this information from the students, and you can read it into a device that could be projected on the screen. That's very effective. Let's see, what app am I using? This is into Google Docs mainly. There are some other things mentioned in the in that article, the blog post, that, for example, something called Google Docs Story Builder, Docs Story Builder. You can Google that, D-O-C, Docs Story Builder. This is one word. And that's a fun little tool that I have students use. Again, they can try and voice into the app if they want. But when I write on paper, I forgot to continue what I was going to say there. When they write on paper, I can take what they've written, and then I can read from the paper into a Google Doc, which they share with me. So I have them write on paper, and then they share a Google Doc with me, and I'll take the paper and read it into the Google Doc. So then they've got what they can do in writing, and they've now got it into a Google Doc, which is very hard for them to get it there. But in the Google Doc, we can work with it, you know. So, and as I said, I can sometimes the students will ask me, "How do you spell a word?" And I just hit the button and read contribute, you know, and then the word appears in the Google Doc. So, it's a lot easier than having to telegraph the spellings, you know, which we used to have to do. They're always asking me things like that. Send them to a dictionary, or you can just okay, here it is. So this is several of the things that I'm doing, and you can get maybe a bigger picture and a wider perspective in that blog article.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I kind of totally agree that my handwriting has deteriorated. My handwriting was never good, but it's really, really bad now.
Doesn't matter.
Who needs it? And I was playing around with my iPad as you were talking, and I hadn't realized that you could use voice to comment on a doc. So if a student has their doc open and is working, you can comment on it. What I'm not seeing is how they view comments. They have to click the comment.
It highlights it. Puts a yellow highlight on the in their document, and they you touch the highlight, and the option on the right is comment. When they touch comment, the comment appears.
Got it.
Yeah, there's always something with it. It's always difficult to figure out how to do things, but the students usually can crack these little conundrums
within
iPad. A minute, and then everybody knows.
I just have another question. Is it possible to turn off autocorrect, the spelling autocorrect? It drives me nuts. Any iPad users out there?
Sorry. I'll turn off my air conditioner, started splashing the water everywhere. Oh, there's where it's using from. Where the fuck is that? Okay, so anyway, the air conditioner is just sort of running water. I really don't know. I know how to do it on my Android phone.
Jeff, I think there. I'm just now looking as you mention it, and I went into general keyboards. And there's a list of options, one being auto correction. Don't know if you see that option.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes.
Or check spelling. Might be one or the other or both of those. Does that do anything?
I hope so. I'll let you know. Thank you.
Vince, I had a question about that. Do I understand you that then the student, as a means of data entry, they're using voice activation or voice recognition to convert the text? Is that correct?
In our class situations, we've got large classes and they can be noisy. So, and the students don't really quite understand the, we can figure out that if you have to read things carefully, or you have to articulate in a certain way, and so it actually works very well for me, but with the students it doesn't often work. So that's why I've gone to the technique of having them start the writing on paper and then I read it into them. It just works a lot better for them, and it eases through some frustration. But they could do that, and some of them can, and of course, they seem to like the feature.
I was curious if if the voice activation, let's say that the student chooses to use a voice recognition to input written work, what the editing and revision process might look like when compared to either the student writing it out by hand on a notebook or using a keyboard to actually type it in that way, just from a cognitive standpoint, the learning, process or the thinking process that is involved in one data entry versus being, speaking and then going back and editing. So that's curious to me. Trying to think of, how the two might compare.
Yeah, another thing I do with the students, I use two features, as I say in that article. The only two things I ever write in their article. I don't try to write, to click in their articles and try to write things in there. I only make comments and I make strike-throughs. So either you can strike through something if they put in something extra, or, and they can see that. And that can be done by a shortcut on a PC. Usually if I'm doing that kind of thing, I do it on a PC. But although there is a plus at the top of the Docs app window now that will actually let you add comments with a touch. That didn't used to be there even before last summer. But and you couldn't, at that time you could also, it was very difficult to insert a picture into a Google Doc through the iPad. But that plus also has the option of inserting a picture. So that's some improvement that has been made recently to the Google Docs app. It seems like it should have been there all along. But in any event, so the other thing, so either I strike through or I make comments. comments are on the PC, it's Control-Alt-M on a PC. And so just that shortcut, you highlight what you want to comment on, Control-Alt-M, and then you can write or speak into the, well, on a PC, there is a speaking tool you can use, but that's a little bit complicated. Usually I write on the PC, or on, if I'm, like I said, in the middle of the class, or it's just easier to interact with them, talk to them, and put that into, you know, I can make suggestions. I can make, oh, here, you need to do this. You know, I can talk to them. I can tell them what they need to do. And while I'm telling them that, it all appears in the comment. So actually, you have to click a check to get the comment to register. But they're quite surprised when I've just told them something, and then a moment later, it appears in their document, what I just told them. So it's a really nice feature, nice affordance.
And Benjamin is asking about correction code systems, which I find, even aside from tech, kind of an interesting question. When you're teaching writing, how much do you make specific corrections? How much do you point out, okay, there's something that needs fixing here? What I've done in the past using Google Docs is a color-coded highlighting system. So I will highlight it in a certain color if it's a usage error, or a different color if it's a different kind of error, and sometimes I'll make comments, which I just found when I've taught writing before, the more work I do in telling them what the problem is, the less they retain it. And the more they have to struggle to figure out what the solution is and what's the problem, the less likely they are to repeat it.
And when you use comments, they have to fix it. So you know, you can just tell them what to do, and then they have to go in and figure out and fix it. And they often do. Whereas if I use a system, sometimes they just ignore it, or they just don't seem to do it so often. But when I leave a comment, they have to go back in the text and correct it. And so, you know, I think it sticks a little bit better. It's also similar to Russell Stannard's Camtasia or Gene correction system, and that is he brings their document up on a screen, and does a screencast while he's correcting them and talking to them. So, his students, from his account, seem to like that. So, so this is kind of similar to that, and especially when you're working with a large number of students, it's it'll let you get it. It'll actually make a lot of corrections that appear, I think, are more productive than anything I've tried in the past. I've just been kind of refining that as I go. That's kind of the point I've reached so far.
You know, Vance, it's funny because I do almost the exact same system. And I didn't do that when I used to use Microsoft Word, but the strike through, I'll also use bold occasionally if I'm going to insert something, and comments can all be done through shortcuts. And they make you, it's a lot faster. If I have to go and highlight and find a tooltip and click on it, it's going to take me all day. Like I said, I've got students in my writing classes, so it's a lot of editing. And so, but I think kind of the technology pushed me into that direction, and I justified it pretty much in the same way that you are, saying that if I make a comment, and they have to correct it, and I'm not doing it for them.
And we started on this talking about rubrics. So what I can do is I can give them a checklist of things that they have to have in their document, and then when I can give them a little bit of feedback, but then I can put them back, okay, I see this, this, and this. It's in the checklist. Go here, take this checklist and tick off, you know, what you've done and what you haven't done. Do it. So, so that gets back to the rubric and the checklist I use for marking.
Yeah, very similar. I put mine in the first comment in the paper is my checklist, and then I'll say these are things that you're responsible for, because I only grade what we've talked about in class. And so throughout the semester, it gets longer and longer and longer.
I'm curious how others feel, or if they what systematic approach you take. If you look at, generally speaking, writing errors in two general categories, one being kind of global errors, that is those errors that tend to interfere with communication, versus local errors that are more grammatical, mechanical, that don't necessarily interfere with the actual message. How do you approach those two types of errors when you're looking at a paper for the first time, or if you even make a distinction between the two?
Okay. I don't know if I really make a distinction between the two. I teach, all of my students are juniors and seniors in English education. They're pretty high level overall, though certainly not all of them. But at that point, we're really going more towards, I don't want to say error-free writing. That's not possible, but as error-free as possible, I guess. So I don't really distinguish between the two that much. However, if there's something that I simply don't understand, I just highlight it and mark it with a question mark.
Yeah, I find it's more effective to go over the global issues, the communication ones, especially my students. They just... I'm sure they're a lot different from Korean students who really seem more serious to me about actually learning the language. These guys that I teach, they just don't pay attention to that little detail, and so you can work with it. You can spend a lot of time working on that. I think they need the fluency. They need to get their ideas out, and then that will come along and correct their grammar. But we work on it. We do mark it. They have to take IELTS-type tests, which are kind of heavy on grammar and spelling and that sort of thing. They get that in other things apart from writing. They're marked on grammar and spelling and what they write on reading tests, for example. But I really like working with students and working with their minds. And I like to I sort of tend to, especially when you're working in comments, I can make comments if it seems appropriate about the grammar in the paper, but I ignore a lot of mistakes because it's not going to improve everything, but I really want them to get the ideas out, the ideas across.
And I would say it also depends on the type of assignment. Like, I want them to have writing opportunities where it's just about expressing themselves, and I'm not going to be so nitpicky, and as long as I can understand what they're saying, that's great. If they're practicing writing a cover letter for a job application or something, I'd probably be more going over it with a fine-tooth comb. Maria, how are you doing?
Hi, Harry. I didn't want to interrupt because as compared to you, I'm writing a card down here in Argentina. As far as I've heard, I haven't heard anyone using any of these approaches to teaching anything, let alone writing. But I have a comment to say that as regards correcting, I've heard that non-native speakers of the language, such as myself, we are more, fussy about mistakes. And so what I'm trying to do now is not pay attention to the little details, but focus more on communication. I teach one-on-one, which, this is like the ideal place to learn, but I try to focus on the meaning, on what the students want to say. But I got this student, and I feel like frustrated on that aspect, because I got this student who wanted to pass an exam at the teacher training college, and she came here for my help, and she failed. So I said, probably I have to change the way I teach, and that's why I'm just listening to everything you're saying, because I feel like I failed there, and I have to work on that as a teacher. That's what I wanted to say. And thank you so much. I'm learning a lot.
And it's been a long time since I've taught writing courses in particular, so I'm also very interested in people's thoughts on what's effective. What do you feel like has been most helpful to your students actually making writing progress.
I was just going to point out David's question in the one on gamification in the hangout here. The answer could have something to do with that. Is anybody using gamification techniques? I would like to invite David to join us in the conversation, by the way. You could always articulate your question. And that would be something that might engage students. I can't think of how I use gamification in writing exactly. But anyway.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to come in very, very well. The internet here is not so good, so maybe a thumbs up. Do I sound okay? Oh, okay. Look, the way gamification can work for writing is basically you align a particular achievement, say badges. You know, when we were kids and we'd write in our notebook and we'd get a little sticker, smiley face, because you were able to write a complete sentence with completely error-free. So let's build a scenario here. You want to teach your students to write a simple paragraph with an introductory sentence, some supportive details, and a conclusion. And let's just say it's an opinion-based piece. So the first thing you want to do is make sure that they're able to write a sentence. And so that would be an achievement. And the student doesn't need you to point out every mistake. If they don't get that achievement, they got to go back and rewrite until they get that achievement. Once they get that achievement, then they know they've written the sentence the way that they should be. Of course, you've been teaching them grammar, vocabulary, spelling techniques, everything that they need to build that sentence. But instead of pointing out, hey, you didn't capitalize the first letter, you forgot there's a comma, if you begin with a subjunctive coordinator, like if, we've done all of these things, so they should be able to find their own mistake. So they get the perfect sentence. You got yourself your introductory sentence, and then there'd be another achievement for a reward like sentence variety. If you're able to write in your paragraph at least three different types of sentences that we've been talking about, let's say simple, simple complex, complex sentences, boom, you got another achievement, and so on. And then the students themselves can work together, so that could be another achievement. So you're able to do peer review, you get an achievement for that. And as long as you set this up at the beginning, the students are aware that they don't get a completed grade until they've reached their achievements, because there's no point in grading a paper that is a complete mess. And the student has to take ownership of that, because as Jeff pointed out, and the reality is not just in Korea, I'm in the Caribbean, and the students will let you do everything for them, and they won't make a concerted effort to figure it out on their own, because they know that you'll circle their spelling mistakes and you'll write down, hey, remember, capitalize, third person singular rule, what's wrong with you? You've made this mistake 15 times in a row. So it can get frustrating. So I found that by giving the students achievement awards, they spring up to attention a little bit more. And you could even align your achievements as grades. For example, our students are on a 5-point structure. So you could say, look, there are 6 possible achievements that you need to get. You explain each achievement. If you can get 5 of them, you get a perfect grade, and so on. If you can't get 4, close to failing, and you're good at the course. So that's all I got to say about that. Does anyone have any?
Well, I think it would be a good idea. I don't know if I'm getting through, am I? Oh, okay. I think it would be a good idea to try to align that to some kind of rubric that we already have in the classes. I could simply see that, I suppose. Have them competing for those. Do you use any systems to help you track achievements? There's something online. Wasn't Purdue University doing something that, have you checked that out? They had little, you know, icons that you could hand out to students, and I think you could even track them through their website. I literally hear crickets outside my window.
Yeah, I'm not aware of I know Purdue's OWL site is great for writing. Vance probably knows a lot more about the badges and stuff.
I wonder what context, David, do you teach? Are you teaching young children, I would imagine? Or university? Where are you teaching?
You're muted, Dave.
You're muted.
Yeah, maybe it'd be better if I just leave it. Okay, I only have a few minutes, and then I have to go to a meeting. But yeah, I'm at Uni Norte. It's in Barranquilla, Colombia. But I was teaching in high school as well, and of course I had to teach English literature and writing to students that English was their second language, or basically a foreign language for many of them. But I picked up the whole thing about gamification from teachers that are actually teaching writing in the United States to, you know, first language speakers. But I saw a potential there because a lot of students weren't really focusing or paying attention to the symbols like subject verb agreement, you know, the little, you know, CAP for capital letter. And I was going through this problem that Jeff mentioned earlier, so I thought, why don't I use what these other teachers are using? And they align their badges with their rubrics. They use a learning management system to help keep things organized. I don't know if you've heard of Edmodo, so that could work. Or your university has align achievements or give achievements to students. Blackboard has achievements, for example. I don't know so much about Moodle, but if you don't have those, there's lots of things. You can create a wiki space, and it's just basically that way. Or you could use tons of things that give students avatars if you're worried about their privacy. What's an avatar? If you don't know, instead of the number and just that image, and then you can have a spreadsheet that shows their achievements so that they can feel some kind of sense of pride in where they stand or stack against the class, but nobody knows exactly who that person is. In distance learning, it's easy to each other really that often, but in a classroom environment, some students might be shy or under-motivated to perform because they're worried about people laughing at them. So, I mean, there's a lot of different things to do, but yeah, you want to align achievements with your rubric, and it's just really narrowing all that complexity that we teachers take for granted because we know our rubrics. The students, I don't know, my experience is they don't really read the rubric. And symbols, simple symbols like achievement badges, hey, do A get this badge? Do B get this badge? Do this get this badge? And if you get enough badges, you pass. It just works that way. So, if there's no other questions, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to bail on you guys. Well, I actually have to learn about them.
I did want to say, I think I found what I was looking for. I think it's a Purdue Passport, and it's a kind of a badge system that they've put together.
Yeah, Purdue's pretty good, and for the most case, you can get a lot of free stuff from them, especially... What I like is getting the information about how to follow APA. for my own writing.
And there are automatic API generators now, aren't there? Just like we don't have to spell anymore. Now with the spell checkers, hopefully we don't have to memorize APA anymore.
Yeah, if you use sitefast.com, you can actually just put in, like, say the title of the journal, and it'll pretty much find everything for you and then put everything in a nice, tidy package. Had I known that it existed 3 years ago, I might have had an easier time getting my paperwork done for the university, but hey, it's never too late.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us, David. And
I'll look forward to the next one. Best of luck with everyone in improving writing outcomes with your students. Cheers.
Thanks.
Hi. Yeah,
I'm gonna
passport.
I've got a class here in 10 minutes. Thanks everyone for a great discussion. I always enjoy it. Look forward to the next one. And we'll see you. See you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Okay. I see you again. Yeah, just one final comment, I suppose. The Purdue Passport appears to be an e-portfolio system. And well, you can use a system, or you can, when I try to get my students doing e-portfolios, or what I call e-portfolios, I generally have them set up a blog, or one of my colleagues, my team teacher actually, is having them use Google Sites. Google Sites has really nice tabs down the side where you can, she set up categories for them, like task 1, task 2, task 3, and the students fill in the, in a way she's kind of set up a template for them to fill in their accomplishments on their own web page. And of course they can blog their accomplishments, they can, you know, produce any number of artifacts that would fill in those links, or where they can, at least they have a web page, or they have a space, an online space they can show their parents. And from that, you start filling in the things that you want them to do, and it, in aggregate, it makes a really nice picture, and it lists their writing, and I think it's it showcases their work basically. So there are many systems that you can use.
If
personally,
you can
I prefer the ones
on
that
site,
I just set up myself.
Send it my way. I'd love to add that to the show notes.
What's that?
The link to her site, her Google site.
Ah.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, it's the student sites. The students keep their own. But anyway, yeah, I'll see what I can find. I'm not sure how public they are, because we sort of, our students they're military, you know, so we have to be careful with some of these things. But I can send you, if you want, I can send you what I did with my last group of students, which
please do.
They all, I'll send you some stuff you can have a look at.
Any other final thoughts, Maria or Dan?
I think that's good for tonight.
Yeah, what I found very, very, really, really interesting was the rubrics, the descriptors and all that, because once you're teaching writing, the students should know what they are supposed to do or write. That's not the way I learned how to write. I don't even know if I write well, because we didn't have any of this stuff when I was a student, and that's what's really exciting about what you're doing, that students being responsible for what they're learning and to know really what they are supposed to do. That's what I like.
What was most effective for you, Maria, in learning to write English? Was there a method or a teacher or anything that was especially useful?
At the time I was learning, we didn't have access to material or content. It was really extremely expensive and difficult for us to get. There was no internet, and the books were extremely expensive. And the teachers just came and said, okay, this is a story, you're supposed to write another story. And that was it. It was I was lost, and it was fascinating. Once there was this teacher who came and wrote on the blackboard a lot of phrases we could use for the introduction, for the during the story, and the conclusion of the story, and I just loved her. And then it wasn't until I started teaching that I started to have access to more material, and so that's why it was like a dark space where I had to figure out how to go about. I didn't like that at all. And today, what I find, when I was told by a teacher at the teacher training college, was that teachers are not open when it comes to what they are doing inside their classrooms. So something such as what Benjamin is doing is unthinkable. I haven't heard about this here in Argentina. I don't know why, but it's not happening, and I don't think it's going to happen in the near future either. I've been invited to talk, or sometimes I am having tea with some friends, and when I tell them what you do, they look at me as if I was talking in another language. That's why. Or if I say, for example, there is this teacher, and he makes, like, it's Jeff, the one who makes the students talk to a global audience, they look at me as if it was, you know, something, well, that we could never do that in Argentina. Why not? I don't know why. Well,
they expect to have to pay for it. That's what I found with my Argentine colleagues, Rita Zeinsteyer, for example, Jennifer Brashear, people that I went to visit them in Buenos Aires, and they said they had to put a fee on anything or people wouldn't come. And also, I was amazed that the cafes, the coffee houses, the restaurants were all had Wi-Fi. Everyone had their devices out. Everyone was connecting with one another. But in the as far as education is concerned, no, they weren't. Yeah. They weren't making that connection at all. Yeah. So
well,
I found that very strange.
Well, you know what? Two or three weeks ago, I was invited to a conference, and I was asked to give a talk on connected learning, which is a challenge here in Argentina, they said. But there wasn't Wi-Fi in the venue, so I had to figure out how to talk about connectedness without connection. But well, I did it. But I'm not sure that at the end of the conference, the attendees were given a feedback form, and I don't think they will write a good comment on my session because. I don't think they saw any relevance in what I was telling them. I don't know. I don't care either because I'm having such much fun with you and I'm learning
and
so much.
You're ahead of the game because it used to be in the UAE almost 20 years ago when I came here that social networks were blocked, and when I went out and talk to teachers about some of these things, they sort of, well, we can't do this here, we just can't do it, you know. And the next thing you know, they're unblocked. You know, like 15 years ago, everything's unblocked. All of a sudden, everything comes open. Now, nothing's blocked. It's things are just completely opened up. People are much more attuned to that sort of thing. So, and it's nice to be positioned. I always told teachers that you've got to be positioned for when it happens so that you're in control, because
exactly.
If you're not positioned, the students are going to control it. And I mean, like what happened in Los Angeles, for example, I think that's what it was, where they handed out iPads and all of a sudden the students cracked them and made a big mess, and they eventually had to confiscate them back. Anyway, that's okay. A good example of teachers not being at the right end of the train, let's say.
It makes me so sad to see so much possibilities being lost, because there's so much potential for collaboration and with things that like this that are going on a daily basis, and that's what makes me sad. I try to do my thing here. For example, I've been substituting in public schools, and I've done some connection stuff without Wi-Fi, and the students are the engagement of the students is so high. But well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and then you can model it. That's another thing. You can be the model. Yeah. Do you know Jennifer Brashear or Rita Zeinsteiger?
Yeah, I'll be with her in a conference in September. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there will be a congress for teachers of English here in the annual conference will be the 24th of September, and I will be seeing her and Nikki Hockley also, who is coming here. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking forward to the conference. I will be presenting on content curation. So if you have any ideas, all are welcome.
Sounds like a good topic for our next ELT Live.
All right.
You're in charge.
Oh, my.
Yeah, why not?
Well, okay. Thanks. As always, great to connect with everybody, and hope those who are beginning a semester have a great start, and I think I'll schedule something for next week, try to keep this thing going.
Good luck with your... Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon.